The first part of the trek was balky and frustrating as the snowshoes or the bindings that held them to the other's feet seemed to give out every few steps. The whole expedition seemed to have failed before it had started. But then I noticed we'd been going for a whole hour without pause. I sipped from the tube that ran down to my water pouch and munched slowly on an energy bar. I looked around me and actually enjoyed the view. All's well. The thought hit me like a snowball in the nose. I'd been out of the consent for a little more than 2 weeks, eating Extramuros food the whole time. Leo and Arsabalt and the others had probably made it to Tredegar in less than a week, too brief a time for them to be affected. But I had been out long enough that the ubiquitous chemical must have taken up residence in my brain, subtly altering the way I thought about everything. What would my Fraz and Sewers have said about the decisions I had been making recently? Nothing too polite. Just look at where those decisions had gotten me. And yet, even in the midst of this terrible situation, I'd been strolling around with nothing on my mind except for how pretty the view was. I tried to force myself into a sterner frame of mind, tried to envision some bad outcomes so that I could lay plans. Braj's sticker might serve as an anchor in a crisis, but he might just as well use it to cut himself free if one of us fell in. What should I do in that event? But it was no use. Braj had made himself the leader and had made reasonable decisions to this point. There was no limit to the amount of time and energy I could put into spinning such alarming fantasies in my head. Better to attend to the here and now. Or was that the all's well talking? For the first few hours, we followed the tamped-down tracks left by the tractor. Then they veered downhill, following a cirque, a crescent-shaped vale cut by a tributary glacier, down toward the valley floor. This would take us straight to the military convoy, and so here we broke away from the trail and ventured across trackless snow for the first time. The first bit was slow going as we had to work our way up out of the cirque. By the time the slope began to level, I was ready to pull the ripcord in Braj's phrase. If I threw myself on the mercy of some military Drummond operator, what was the worst that could happen? I hadn't broken any laws. It was only my three companions who had to go to such ridiculous lengths to avoid the authorities' notice. But for better or worse, I was roped up to them and couldn't cut myself free without endangering their lives and mine. I had to wait for them to pull the ripcord. Then we crested a subsidiary ridge and came in view of the coastline. I was startled at how close it was. We had to shed some altitude, but the horizontal distance didn't look that great. We could easily pick out individual buildings in the port and count the military transport ships moored at its piers. Military aircraft were lined up at the edge of a dirty landing strip wedged in between the coast and the foot of the mountains. We watched one take off and bank to the south. One or two civilian ships were also in the harbor, and this gave us all the idea that if we could only get down there in one piece, which looked like less than a day's travel, we could buy passage on one of them and get out of here behind the next icebreaker. So we took a rest up there in preparation for what we all knew would be a long and arduous final push. I forced myself to eat two more energy bars. The things were starting to make me sick, but perhaps that was just me worrying about the all's well. I washed them down with water and refilled my snow pouches and my fuel bladder. Our supplies were holding up well. The sledge drivers had given us plenty, perhaps thinking that they might not be returning for a while. I was glad we had taken action, moved out, instead of huddling in that tent, not knowing if we'd live or die. After an hour's rest, we repacked the toboggan and got underway again. We descended into a round-bottomed cleft, another cirque that cut across our path and seemed to curve toward the port. Braj decided to follow this one down. The risk was that it would become too steep for us to negotiate and that we'd have to backtrack. On a few occasions during the next couple of hours, I became very worried about this, but then we would come around a bend or crest a little rise and get a view of the next mile or so and see that there was nothing we couldn't handle. On steeper bits, the toboggan would try to run ahead of me, and then I would have my hands full for a while. The only remedy was to slew it round ahead of me and let it pull me downhill as I leaned back against its weight. At such times, the others, who didn't have to contend with such a burden, would outdistance me. The rope joining me to Lara would draw taut and remind me of his impatience. I felt like reeling him in and smacking him. But Braj kept our pace from running out of control. Even in stretches that looked smooth and safe, he plodded along at the same rate, pausing every couple of steps to probe the snow ahead of him with his tent pole. I had long since learned to distinguish Braj's snowshoe prints from those of the others, and from time to time I would notice, to my indescribable annoyance, that they had diverged. Braj had zigged for whatever reason, and Dag had zagged, and Laro followed in his kinsman's steps, obligating me to do the same, and hence pass over ground that Braj had not probed. We had probably shed 3/4 of the altitude needed to reach the port. It would be relatively easy going from here. Laro and Dag were laborers. They had plenty of energy left and yearned to push on past the plodding Braj to a place where they could get a hot meal and peel off the accursed suit sacks. It was on one of those steep bits where the toboggan had swung around in front of me and I was straining back against 2 ropes at once that I noticed myself being pulled out of balance. The tension on the rope that connected me to Laro was rapidly increasing. I planted my left snowshoe and pulled back, but the last hour's descent had turned my leg muscles into quivering flab. I collapsed to my knee. The rope at my waist was pulling me forward. Just before I planted my face in the snow, I collected a glimpse of Braj standing up facing me, 100 feet away, sticker in hand. Laro was sliding and tumbling down the slope, pulling me with him. Dag, who was roped between Braj and Laro, was nowhere to be seen. That remembered image was all I had to go on during the next little while, because I was face down, being pulled along by Laro and by the toboggan. And, I realized, by Dag. He must have fallen into a crevasse. Why hadn't Braj stopped his fall? The rope, the frayed yellow 30-foot poly rope that had connected Braj to Dag, must have snapped. Either that or Braj had cut it with a swipe of his sticker. I was the only person who could stop this, and save Laro, Dag, and myself. I had to plunge that L-shaped piece of metal into the ice. I should have had it out and ready to use, should have been watching ahead for signs of trouble, but in order to free both hands to wrangle the toboggan, I'd stuck it in one of the equipment loops on the outside of my suit sack. Was it still there? I kicked wildly with one leg and managed to roll over on my back. My head was plowing up a bow wave of snow that buried my face. I snorted it out of my nose and stifled the urge to inhale. I groped around until I felt something hard and pulled it out, or so I guessed. Through those mittens, it was hard to tell what was going on. I got the pick pointed away from my body, flailed the legs again, and managed to roll over on my stomach. My head came up out of the snow, and I heard Laro screaming something. He must have gone over the brink of the crevasse. I put all of my weight on top of that L-shaped hunk of metal and drove it down. It caught, sort of, and became a pivot. My body spun around it as the rope at my waist, now drawn by the combined weights of Laro and Dag, torqued me downhill. The pick tugged at my hands, but not all that hard. It didn't seem to be holding. Or rather, it held, but it held in a raft of snow that had broken loose and was now sliding down the hill beneath me. This was just plain bad luck. If we had been traversing packed snow, the pick would have had something firm in which to get purchase. But yesterday's storm had left the packed ice covered with powdery stuff that slid freely on top of it. Another vicious jerk at my waist told me that the toboggan had just hurtled over the edge. I raised my face up out of this mini avalanche and got the weird idea that I wasn't actually moving, because, of course, the snow around me was moving at the same speed as I. Then there was nothing under my toes, nothing under my ankles, nothing under my knees, my hips. The rope jerked me straight down with the weight of 3 men. I guess I did a sort of backflip into the crevasse. But I only got to experience the terror of freefall for a fraction of a second before something terrible happened to my back and I stopped. The rope's force was pulling me down against something immobile and hard. Loose snow continued to pummel me for a while. I remembered a woolly story that Yul had told me about getting caught in an avalanche, the importance of swimming, of preserving airspace in front of one's face. I couldn't swim, but I did get one arm up and crooked an elbow over my mouth and nose. The weight of snow on my body built steadily. The tension on the rope slackened. Most of the avalanche seemed to be parting around me, falling away to either side as I remained stuck. For some reason, I heard Jessery's voice in my head saying, "Oh, so you're only being buried alive a little bit." What a jerk. Then it stopped. I could hear my own heart beating and nothing else. I pushed outwards with my elbow. The snow moved a little and gave me a void in front of my face. Air for a moment. More importantly, it kept me from panicking and let me open my eyes. There was dim blue-gray light. I could hear Archibald saying, "Just enough to read by," and Leo answering,
"If only you'd thought to bring a book."
For whatever reason, I was not falling into the crevasse. Yet. And I didn't think I'd fallen too far into it. Something had stopped my fall. I guessed that the toboggan had gotten lodged sideways between the crevasse walls and I'd fallen on it. Hard. I took a moment to wiggle my toes and my ankles, just to verify that I hadn't broken my spine. It would have been nice to explore with my hands, but one was pinned at my side and the other, the one I'd crooked over my face, was hemmed in by snow. I was, however, able to move that one downwards over my body. I found the zipper pull from my front pocket and inched it open. Then I moved that hand up to my face and pulled my mitten off with my teeth. I reached my bare hand down into the open pocket and fished out my sphere. Spheres don't have controls as such. They recognize gestures. You talk to them with your hands. My hand was a little stiff, but I was able to make the unscrewing gesture that caused the sphere to get bigger. After a while, this became a little scary because the sphere was stealing my air supply, claiming the void in front of my face and pressing on my chest. But I had the idea that the snow over me wasn't that deep, so I kept telling it to expand. And just when I thought my own sphere was going to squeeze the life out of me, I heard rushing noises, a small avalanche. I reversed the gesture. The sphere got small, the weight came off, and I found myself gazing up through clear air between walls of blue ice. The sky was visible. And so was Braj, standing at the edge of the crevasse, looking down at me. I had fallen about 20 feet.
"You're about,"
was the first thing he said to me.
"Yes."
"Got anything else in your bag of tricks? Because I have no rope. It all went down with those two geeths."
He patted the length of yellow rope tied around his waist. Only a foot or so dangled below the knot. It had been severed at exactly the point where the blade of his sticker would have intercepted it in a moment of panic. Or of calculation.
"I thought maybe you caught it," I said.
I don't know why. I guess it was that weird avowed compulsion to state facts.
"Maybe I did."
We looked at each other for a while. It occurred to me that Braj was an exceptionally rational man, more so than some avowed. He was another like the Crades or Cord or Artisan Quinn who was smart enough to be an avowed, but who, for whatever reason, had ended up extramuros. In his case, it seemed that being alone out here with no bond to anyone else like him had made him utterly calculating and ruthless.
"Let's say you don't care whether I live or die," I said. "Let's say that every decision you've made has been based on self-interest. You kept us alive, brought us with you, and roped yourself to us because you knew that if you fell in, we'd try to help you. But the minute one of us fell in, you cut the rope to save yourself. You looked down into this crack out of simple curiosity. Nothing more. Then you saw my sphere. You know I'm avowed. What's your decision?"
Braj had found all of this faintly amusing. He rarely heard intelligent people state things clearly, and he sort of enjoyed its novelty. He pondered my question for a minute or so, turning away at one point to look down the slope. Then he turned back to scrutinize me.
"Move your legs,"
he said. I did.
"Arms."
I did.
"Those geeths were more trouble than they were worth," he said.
"Is that an ethnic slur for what Laro and Dag are?"
"Ethnic slur? Yes, an ethnic slur,"
he said in a mocking tone.
"Geeths are great for digging ditches and pulling weeds, worse than useless up here. But you might keep me alive. How are you going to get out of there?"
For 3,700 years, we had lived under a ban that prevented us from owning anything other than the bolt, the cord, and the sphere. Shelves of books had been written about the ingenious uses to which these objects had been put by avowed who had found themselves in trying circumstances. Many of the tricks had names. Saint Ablevan's ratchet, Ramgad's contraption, the lazy fraw. I was no expert, but when we'd been younger, Jessery and I had leafed through some such books and practiced a few of those tricks, just for sport. Cords and bolts were made of the same stuff, a fiber that could coil into a tight helix, becoming short and bulky and springy, or relax into a straight filament, becoming long, lean, and inelastic. In the winter, we told the fibers in our bolts to coil up. They got much shorter, but the bolt became thick and warm because of the pockets of air involved with those coils. In summer, we straightened them, and the bolts became long and sheer. Likewise, the cord could be fat and yarn-like, or long and thready. I made my sphere about as big as my head, wrapped my bolt around it, and tied it together with my cord. Then I made the sphere get bigger and let the bolt expand with it. The sphere wedged itself between the walls. It could go up, but it wouldn't go down, because the crevasse was wider at the top and narrower below. I pushed it up a short distance, and it found a new equilibrium, a little higher. Then I expanded and pushed, a few inches at a time. The walls were surprisingly irregular, so all of this was more complicated than I'm making it sound. But once I got the hang of it, it went fast.
"Got it,"
Braj called. The sphere moved away from me, scraping against the ice walls. A panic came over me until I found my cord with a flailing arm. Then I let it slide through my hand until Braj had pulled the sphere all the way out of the crevasse. Braj and I were now linked by the cord. He jammed his sticker into the ice up there and wrapped my cord around its handle. Or so he claimed. I didn't want to lose our connection to the toboggan and to Laro and Dag, but I had to cut myself free of it to have any hope of bettering things. The end of my cord I joined to the loop of rope around my waist. Then I cut my way free from that loop. So I was free of the hundreds of pounds of stuff anchoring me to the bottom. The cord was now our only link to the toboggan and to Laro and Dag. I gave instructions to Braj on how to make the sphere smaller. He threw it down to me. I wedged it between the crevasse walls again. This time, now that I had freedom to move, I was able to get astride it. For the first time since the accident, I took my weight off of whatever hard thing had stopped my fall and saved my life. Looking down at it, I verified that it was indeed the toboggan, wedged at an angle between the crevasse walls like a stick thrust between a monster's jaws. When I took my weight off of it, it shifted, and a moment later it fell, tumbling another 10 feet before getting wedged again. Braj had anchored his loop of the cord to his sticker, jammed in the ice, so we didn't lose it. I was able to extricate myself from the crevasse by expanding the sphere, which pushed me up as it inflated, while keeping the cord looped around one hand in case I fell off. Once I was out, we doubled the anchor by driving in my makeshift ice axe and secured the cord to that as well. For a little while, we were able to haul the rope up by causing the cord to get shorter, a simple implementation of Saint Ablevan's ratchet. But after a few minutes, it ran out of stored energy. If I left it out in the sun for a while, it would recharge, but we didn't have time, and it wasn't able to store a lot of energy anyway. So after that, Braj and I hauled using muscle power. Once we had gotten the toboggan up on the surface, this became markedly easier. A few moments later, Laro's corpse could be seen deep down in the valley of blue light, emerging from the snow that had piled up in the bottom. The rope that trailed below him was no more than 10 feet long and ended in a botched knot. It had held well enough to drag down Laro, me, and the toboggan, but must have given way under the jerk when the toboggan and I came to rest. After that, Dag must have free-fallen to the very bottom of the crevasse and been buried under falling snow. I hoped his death had been quicker than the long, agonizing slide and tumble that had preceded it. Braj kept throwing me dirty looks as if to say, "Why are we doing this?" But I ignored him and kept pulling on the rope until we had brought Laro's body up to the brink of the crevasse. As we were rolling him up onto the surface at last, he twitched, gasped, and called out the name of his deity. Now I understood Braj. He was smarter, more rational than I at the moment. He had probably been wondering, what'll we do if he turns out to be alive? I just lay there on the snow for a few minutes, half dead. All the injuries I had suffered in the fall were now making themselves obvious. There was nothing to do but go on. Braj was furious to have been burdened with an injured man and kept stamping around in circles and gazing hungrily down the slope, wondering whether he should chance it alone. After a few minutes, he decided to stay with us, for now. Laro had a broken thigh, and his skull had taken a beating during the fall, creating some bloody lacerations. Between that and being buried in snow for a while, he was groggy. One of Laro's snowshoes still dangled from his foot. I took it apart and used its pieces to splint his leg. Then I made my sphere big and flat on the snow. The sphere is a porous membrane. Each pore is a little pump that can move air in or out. It's like a self-inflating balloon. The spring constant, the stretchiness of the membrane, is controllable. If you turn the stretchiness way down, that is, make it stiff, and pump in lots of air, it becomes a hard little pill. What I did now was the opposite. I made it very stretchy and removed most of the air. I spread my bolt flat on the snow and dragged the flaccid sphere onto it. Then I got Braj to help me roll Laro into the middle. He screamed and cried out to his mother and his deity as we were doing this. I took that as a good sign because he was seeming more alert. I rolled him in the sphere and then wrapped the bolt loosely around that, leaving his head exposed. The whole bundle I tied with my cord. Finally, I inflated the sphere a little bit while telling the bolt not to stretch. The sphere expanded to form an airbed that cocooned Laro's whole body. The bundle was between 2 and 3 feet in diameter and slid over the snow reasonably well, since I'd made the bolt sheer and smooth. I could never have pulled it up a slope, but going downhill ought to work. I towed Laro, and Braj towed the toboggan. We tied ourselves together with a length of good rope that had formerly connected me to Laro, and set out in the same style as before, with Braj going first and using his tent pole to probe for crevasses. I tried not to think about the possibility that Dag might still be alive in the bottom of the crevasse. Then I tried not to wonder how many other migrants' corpses would be found strewn all over this territory if all the ice and snow ever melted. Then I tried not to wonder if Orlo's might be among them. For now, I'd just have to settle for making sure I wasn't among them. I paid close attention to Braj's footprints. If Braj went into another crevasse, I might try to save him, which was why he had kept me alive. But if I went in, Laro and I were both dead. So I stepped where he stepped. After a few hours, I lost awareness of what was happening. Everything I had was channeled into keeping my feet moving. There's not much point in trying to offer a description of the bleakness, the moral and physical misery. In those rare moments when I was lucid enough to think, I reminded myself that Avout had been through far worse ordeals in the third sack and at other such times. Since I was so groggy, I have no way of guessing when Braj parted company with us. Laro's voice brought me to awareness. He was screaming and fighting with the sphere, trying to get out. I told Braj we had to stop. Hearing no answer, I looked around and discovered that he was gone. The rope that had connected us had fallen victim to his sticker. And no wonder. We were on the floor of a valley that led straight to the port, a couple of miles away, and the ground was black and burnished smooth by all the tires and treads that had passed over it. We were on the path of the military convoy. No worries about crevasses here. So Braj had taken off. I never saw him again. Laro was frantic to get out. Perhaps he'd been that way for a long time. I was worried he'd hurt himself flailing around. I inflated the sphere until he couldn't move at all, and then I knelt beside him and looked into his eyes and tried to talk some sense into him. This was monumentally difficult. I had known some, such as Tulia, who could do it effortlessly. Or at least she made it look that way. Yule simply would have bellowed into his face, used the force of his personality. But it was not a thing that came easily to me. He wanted to know where Dag was. I told him Dag was dead, which did nothing to calm him down, but couldn't lie to him, and I was too exhausted to devise a better plan. The sound of engines cut through the still, frigid air. It came from up valley. A small convoy of military fetches was headed our way, detached from the huge procession to go back and run some errand at the port. By the time they approached within hailing distance, Laro had got a grip on himself, if hopeless, uncontrollable sobbing could be so described. I relaxed the sphere, undid the cord, and dragged him free of the bundle, then got everything stowed back in my pockets. Those guys in the military trucks were real pros. They came right over and picked us up. They took us into town. They didn't ask questions, at least none that I remember. Though I was not exactly in a mirthful frame of mind, I marked this down as being funny. With my simple-minded view of the secular world, I'd assumed that the soldiers, simply because they looked sort of like cops with their uniforms and weapons, would act like cops and arrest us. But it turned out that they couldn't have cared less about law enforcement, which made perfect sense once I thought about it for 10 seconds. They took Laro to a charity clinic run by the local Kelks, a religion that was strong in these parts. Then they dropped me off at the edge of the water. I bought some decent food at a tavern and slept face down on the table until I was ejected. Standing out there on the street, I felt stretched thin, diluted, as if that pale Arctic sunlight could shine right through me and give my heart a sunburn. But I could still walk, and I had money. The sledge driver had never collected the second half of his fare. I bought passage on the next outbound transport, boarded it as soon as they'd let me, climbed into a bunk, and slept one more time in that horrible suit sack.
Kelks. 1. A religious faith created during the 16th or 17th century AR. The name is a contraction of the Orth Ganakalux, meaning triangle place, so called because of the symbolic importance of triangles in the faith's iconography. 2. An arc of the Kelks faith. Kedev, a devotee of the Kelks or triangle faith. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
About halfway into the 4-day cruise, I had recovered to the point where I was capable of introspection. I spent a lot of time sitting very still in the ship's mess, eating. I had to sit still because I had messed up my ribs and back in the fall, and it hurt to move, even to breathe. The food was good compared to energy bars. Perhaps I ate so much of it in hopes that it would bring up the level of Allswell in my blood and chase the dark thoughts from my head. Getting me killed couldn't have been part of Frajad's plan. When then had it gone wrong? My foolish choices? The migrant traffic over the pole had been going on at least long enough for Jad to have heard about it. He'd known that a pharaoh like Orlo would take that route to Ekba. So it was an ancient and settled practice. We'd all underestimated its dangers precisely because it was so ancient. We'd assumed that nothing could go on for so long unless it was safe. The way of out would run things if we were in charge. But we weren't in charge, and it wasn't run that way. Or maybe it was a safe and settled thing most of the time, but the military convoy had thrown it into chaos. Or maybe we had just been unlucky.
You look like you've been through a harrowing experience.
I snapped out of it and looked up by rotating my eyeballs, not my head, as I had a terrible crick in the neck. A man was standing there looking at me, probably in his third decade. I had noticed him eyeing me the day before. Now he had come over and said this to me as a way of striking up a conversation. I'm sorry to say I broke out laughing. It took me a minute to get it under control. Harrowing was a thing that we did, literally, to our tangles during the spring. We went through the beds on hands and knees, identifying the weeds and rooting them out with hand hose, throwing the weeds on a pile to be burned, leaving nothing except churned up soil, pulverizing the clods in our hands to leave a loose bed for expansion of the tangle plant's root systems. So when this stranger suggested I'd been through a harrowing experience, my mind went straight to that, and I thought he was trying to say that I looked as if I'd been crawling through dirt, which I did. or perhaps that I looked like a heap of dead weeds, which I also did. Finally, I remembered that I was extramuros, where the old literal meaning of harrowing had been forgotten thousands of years ago, and it had become a cliché, uprooted from any concrete meaning. None of this could be explained to the stranger, so all I could do was sit there and helplessly giggle, which made my ribs hurt, and hope he wouldn't take umbrage and slug me. But he was patient. He even looked a little pained to behold someone in such a pathetic state, which was fortunate, since he was a big man and could have slugged me hard. This gave me an idea that stopped the giggle. "Hey," I said, "do you have any spare clothes? I'd buy them from you."
"You do need clean clothes," the stranger said.
This brought me back to giggling. From time to time, I'd get a whiff of myself. I knew it was bad, but I couldn't very well don my bolt.
"I have more clothes than I need and will gladly part with them," he said.
He had an odd way of talking. Quasi-literate seculars went to stores and bought prefabricated letters, machine-printed on heavy stock with nice pictures, and sent them to each other as emotional gestures. They were written in a stilted language that no one ever spoke aloud, except for this guy who was standing in front of me, letting fly with words like harrowing. He went on,
"I don't ask for anything in return, but I do hope you'll join me for services after you've changed."
So that was it. This guy wanted to convert me to his ark. He had been watching me and had picked me out as a wretch, a soul ripe for saving. I had nothing better to do, and it had become all too obvious that I needed to grow a little wiser in the ways of the secular world. So I threw away my stinking clothes and my suit sack, bathed as best as I could while standing in front of a sink, and put on this guy's funny-smelling clothes. Then I went to a hot, crowded cabin where his ark was holding its services. There were a dozen and a half devotees and one magister, a leathery man named Sark, who apparently spent his life banging around on ships like this, ministering to sailors and fishermen. This was a kelx, a triangle ark. Its adherents were called Kedevs. It was a completely different faith from that of Ganeliel Craed. It had been invented about 2,000 years ago by some ingenious prophet who must have been unusually self-effacing since little was known about him and he wasn't worshipped as such. Like most faiths, it was as fissured and fractured as the glaciers I'd been walking over lately. But all of its sects and schisms agreed that there was another world outside of and greater, in a sense more real, than the one we lived in. That in this world there was a robber who had waylaid a family. He had slain the father outright, raped and killed the mother, and taken their daughter with him as a hostage. Not long after, while trying to evade capture, he had strangled the innocent girl. But he had been caught anyway and locked up in a dungeon for a long time, half of his life, while waiting for his case to come before a magistrate. At the trial, he admitted his guilt. The magistrate had asked if there was any reason why he should not be put to death. The condemned man had responded that there was such a reason, one that had come to him during his years in the dungeon. As he had meditated over his hideous crimes, the one thing he had never been able to chase from his mind was the murder of the girl, the innocent, because in her there had been the potential to do so many things that could now never be realized. In any soul, the condemned man argued, was the ability to create a whole world as big and variegated as the one that he and the magistrate lived in. But if this was true of the innocent, it was true of the condemned man as well, and so he should not, no one should ever, be put to death. The magistrate, upon hearing this, had voiced skepticism that the condemned man really had it in him to generate a whole world. Taking up the challenge, the condemned man had begun to tell the tale of a world he had thought up in his mind, and to relate the stories of its gods, heroes, and kings. This had taken up the whole day, so the magistrate had adjourned the court. But he had warned the condemned man that his fate was still in the balance because the world he had invented seemed to be just as full of wars, crimes, and cruelty as the one that they lived in. The condemned man's stay of execution was only as good as the world he had invented. If the various troubles in that world could not be brought to a satisfactory conclusion in tomorrow's session, he would be executed at sundown. The next day, the condemned man had attempted to satisfy the magistrate and made a little headway, but in so doing introduced new troubles and gave birth to new characters no less morally ambiguous than the first lot. The magistrate could not find sufficient grounds to execute him, and so had continued the case to the next day, and the next, and the next. The world that I lived in with Jessery and Leo and Arcibalt, Orlo and Jad, Ayla and Tulia and Cord and all the others was the very world that was being created from day to day in the mind of the condemned man in that courtroom. Sooner or later it would all end in a final judgment by the magistrate. If our world seemed, on balance, like a decent place to him, he would let the condemned man live, and our world would go on existing in his mind. If the world as a whole only reflected the condemned man's depravity, the magistrate would have him executed, and our world would cease to exist. We could help keep the condemned man alive and thus preserve the existence of ourselves and our world by striving at all times to make it a better place. That's why Alwash, the big stranger, had given me his clothes. He was trying to prevent the end of the world. Kelx was a contraction of the Orth words meaning triangle place. Triangles figured in the Faith's iconography. In the story just told, there were three key characters: the condemned man, the magistrate, and the innocent. The condemned man represented a creative but flawed principle. The magistrate represented judgment and goodness. The innocent was inspiration that had the power to redeem the condemned man. Taken individually, these each lacked something, but taken as a triad, they had created us and our world. Debates as to the nature of this triad had triggered 100 wars, but in any case, they all believed in one interpretation or other of the basic story. At this point in history, the Kelx was very much under the heel of other faiths and had become especially bitter and apocalyptic. The premise of the whole faith was that sooner or later the magistrate would make up his mind, and so the magisters, as their clergy were called, could get their flocks emotionally whipped up as needed by claiming that the judgment was near at hand. Today's sermon was one of those. Kelxes didn't have long, complicated services like the Baesians. The service consisted of a harangue from Magister Sark, followed by interviews with the parishioners, concluded by another harangue. He wanted to know what each man in the cabin, we were all men, had done lately to make the world a better place. We might all be flawed, as how could we not, since we originated in the mind of a rapist and murderer? And yet, because of the pure inspiration that had impregnated the condemned man's soul from the innocent at the moment of her death, we had the power to make the world better in a way that would please the all-seeing and knowing magistrate. Crazy as this all was, I found it sort of compelling in my weakened state, and tried the experiment of playing along with it for a while. This might sound very unlike an avowed, but we were used to being presented with outlandish cosmographical hypotheses, and in our theorics we did this sort of thing all the time. That is, assume for the sake of argument that a hypothesis was true and see where it led. I'd known the tale of the condemned man for almost as long as I'd been alive, but sitting in this cabin, I learned two things about the faith, or at least this sect, that I hadn't known before. One, that the events of our world, which happened in parallel, each person doing something different at the same time, were teased apart and narrated serially by the condemned man to the magistrate. There was no way to tell the stories of billions concurrently, so he broke them down into smaller, more manageable narratives and told them consecutively. So, for example, my trip down the glacier with Braj and Laro and Dag had been related to the magistrate as one self-contained tale, after which the condemned man had doubled back in time to tell the story of what, say, Ayla had done that day. Or if Ayla hadn't done anything unusual, If she hadn't been presented, say, with any great choices, the condemned man might have said nothing of her, and she might thus have avoided the magistrate's scrutiny for the time being. The full attention of the magistrate was focused on only one such story at a time. When your story was being told, you were under the pitiless inspection of the magistrate, who saw everything you did and knew everything you thought. So at such times it was important to make the correct choices. If you attended Kelk's services often enough, you would develop a sixth sense for when your story was being told to the magistrate, and you'd get better at making the right choices. Second, the inspiration that had passed from the innocent to the condemned man at the moment of her death was viral. It passed from him into each of us. Each of us had the same power to create whole worlds. The hope was that one day there would be a chosen one who would create a world that was perfect. If that ever happened, not only he and his world, but all of the other worlds and their creators back to the condemned man would be saved recursively. When Sark turned his hot gaze upon me and asked me what I had done of late to save the world, I, in a spirit of trying to play along, began to tell an edited version of the story of the descent of the glacier. I left out any mention of bolt, cord, and sphere, and I intended to leave out the story of Dag's death, or his being left for dead. But as I went on, I found myself unable to tell the story without including that part of it. It just fell out of me, like an intestine that keeps uncoiling from the belly of a wounded animal. The whole thing had gone out of control. I'd intended to play along as a sort of intellectual parlor game, but my emotions had taken over and dictated what I would say. Something about the whole setup of this arc, I realized, too late, was designed to play on such emotions. I wasn't the first stranger to walk into one of these meetings and spill his guts. They expected it. They counted on it. It was why this Kelks had lasted 2,000 years. When I had finished, I looked over at Alwash, expecting to see a triumphant look on his face. Yeah, he'd gotten me but good. But he didn't look that way at all, just serious and a little sad, like he had known what would happen. He had done it before. He'd had it done to him. The silence that followed was long, but did not feel awkward. Then Magister Sark told me that it wasn't clear I had done anything wrong at all, given the circumstances. I understood this to mean that when the magistrate had heard the story of Braj, Vit, Laro, and Dag from the condemned man, he had not construed it to mean that the latter should be executed. At worst, it was neutral testimony. I felt hugely relieved at this, and in the next moment hated myself for being emotionally manipulated by a witch doctor. If I were still feeling badly about it, Sark concluded, I should try to put on a better showing the next time the condemned man saw fit to relate some part of my affairs in that celestial court. Some of the others had even worse stories to tell to the magister. I could not believe some of what I heard. I wasn't the only first-timer in this congregation. It had been clear from the smirks on others' faces that they too had been dragooned into coming here. I suspected that some were embellishing their stories just to see if they could freak out the magister. Apparently the rule for these services was that after all present had stated what they had to state, the magister would wind things up with a rip-roar. It has been our way since of old to say that the day of the magistrate's final judgment is coming. It is forever coming. But today I tell you that it is here. Signs and portents have made it plain. The magistrate, or his bailiff, has been sighted in the heavens above. He has turned his red eye upon the avowed in their conscience and rendered his judgment upon them. Now he turns his eye upon the rest of us. The so-called warden of heaven has gone before him to make his entreaties, and the magistrate has seen him for what he is and cast him out in wrath. What shall he make of you who are gathered together in this cabin? On his final day before that court, of whom shall the condemned man speak?
shall he tell of you, Vit, and of your doings. To prove that he and all his creations are worthy of life, shall he tell of you, Trade, or you, Theris, or you, Everell? Shall it be your doings on the final day that tip the scales of judgment one way or the other?
It was a tough question. Was meant to be. Magister Sark had no intention of answering it. Instead, he looked long and deep into each man's eyes. Except for mine. I was staring at a bulkhead, trying to figure out what he'd meant. The magistrate had been seen in the heavens. The warden of heaven had been cast out in wrath. Was I supposed to read those statements literally? If something bad had happened to the warden of heaven, what did it mean for Jessery? I was desperate to know. I didn't dare ask. When it was over, I was too drained to move. As the cabin emptied out, I sat slumped against a steel bulkhead, letting the ship's engines jiggle my brain around. One of the other Kedevs had been talking to Alwash. When the cabin was nearly empty, they approached me. I sat up and tried to muster strength to fight back another religious harangue. This new guy's name was Malter.
I was wondering, Malter said, are you one of the Avowt?
I did not move or speak. I was trying to remember what the Kelks thought of us.
Well, the reason I ask, Malter went on, is that there were rumors going around town before we shipped out that an Avowt in disguise had come down the glacier in the last few days and got into trouble just like what you described.
I was startled. Not for long. It was easy to imagine Laro raving to anyone who would listen about his bizarre and tragic adventure with the Avowt who called himself Vit. Maybe I raised an eyebrow or something.
I've always wanted to meet an Avowt, Malter said. I think it would be an honor.
Well, I said, you just met one.
Vout. An Avowt. Derogatory term used extramuros, associated with seculars who subscribe to iconographies that paint the Avowt in an extremely negative way. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Masht was 4 times the size of the city around San Edhar, and as such was the biggest city I'd yet been to in my peregrination, or my life for that matter. To the great consternation of the regulars on this ship, the men who journeyed in transports like this one to and from the Arctic all the time, we were not given leave to enter the harbor and tie up at a pier as usual. Instead, we had to stand off and keep station in the outer harbor. Word filtered down from the bridge that Masht had been thrown into disarray by the military convoys, and that novel arrangements were being worked out from hour to hour. I spent much of that day above decks, just looking at the place, and enjoying being in a part of the world where the weather wasn't trying to kill me. Even though Masht was farther north than Edhar, at 57 degrees of latitude, its climate was moderate because of a river of warm water in the ocean. Having said that, it wasn't warm, just dependably chilly. You could be comfortable if you wore a jacket and stayed dry. Staying dry could be a bit of a project. Masht was built around a fjord that forked into 3 arms. Each arm supported different kinds of facilities. One was military and quite busy. One was commercial. It had been built around the end of the Praxic Age to handle cargo in steel boxes and hadn't changed much since then. Normally, our ship would have put in at a passenger terminal in that district. The third was the oldest. It had been built up out of stone and brick 1,000 years before the reconstitution, during the age when ships moved under power of wind and were unloaded by hand. Apparently there was still a demand for such facilities because smaller vessels went in and out of its stone docks all the time. The old town and the port facilities were built on filled tide flats, incised with networks of canals, narrow and irregular in Old Masht, gridded lanes in the commercial and military sectors. Much of the land that separated the arms of the fjord was too steep to build on. The spires and ridges of stone supported ancient castles, luxury casinos, and radar stations. The territory outside of town was steeper yet, a misty green-black wall with unrecognizable constructs scraped out of it, hanging at crazy angles a mile in the sky. Alwash explained to me that these were places where people paid to slide downhill on packed snow. It didn't appeal to me at the moment. After a day, a tug came out and brought us to a wharf in Old Masht. According to the regulars, this had never happened before. They always went to the new commercial district. So, as much as I was absorbed in the workings of the tug and the shifting views of Old Masht's warehouses, arks, cathedrals, and town center, I had now to give some thought to how I was going to find Cord, Saman, Ganel, and Yule, or how I could help them find me. Should I walk to the commercial port on the assumption they'd be waiting for me there? Or would they have already heard about the disruptions in traffic and be looking for me in Old Masht? As soon as I came down the gangplank, it was clear that Old Masht was the right place. Since the military part of town could not tolerate disarray and the commercial part found it unprofitable, all of the chaos had been pushed into the old town, which had become the kingdom of broken plans and improvisations. All of the city's proper lodgings had been claimed by contractors from the south who were involved in this project of moving the military north, so people were sleeping in mobs and fetches or on the streets. Against them, all doors were locked and many were guarded, so they were channeled into such open spaces as could be found, such as the tops of the wharves, unbuilt stretches of tide flat, and lots where ancient warehouses had been demolished to make room for new projects that had never been realized. This is what the gangplank spewed me into. I shuffled down the ramp, scanning the crowd for my friends. The longer I sought their faces, the lower I was pushed on the ramp and the less I could see. Then I was down in it and could see nothing. Having no plan, I let the currents of the multitude stir me around. When I sensed still pockets or eddies in the flow, I sidled into them and stood and looked about. From what I've described so far, you might think it was a scene of terrible poverty. But the more I observed, the more it was plain to me that there was work to be had here, that people had come to find it, and that what I was seeing, what I had become part of, was a kind of prosperity. Young men queued to talk to important fellows who I assumed were buyers of labor. Many others had come to sell goods or services to those who had found work, so people were cooking food in carts or on open fires, hawking mysterious effects from the pockets of their coats, or behaving in very strange ways that, as I slowly realized, meant that they were willing to sell their bodies. Old road-worn passenger coaches nudged through the crowds at slower-than-walking pace to discharge or take on passengers. The only wheeled transport that seemed to be of any practical use were pedal-powered cycles and motor scooters. Preachers of diverse arcs commandeered pinch points in the flow and shouted gospels and prophecies into crackling amps. There was a lot of uncollected garbage and open-air defecation, which made me glad it wasn't warmer. The generous climate had long attracted immigrants, who came from all over the world, singly or in waves, and climbed up into fjords or mountain valleys to live as they pleased. Over time, they developed their own modes of dress and even distinct racial characteristics. I bought food from a cart. It was easily the best food I'd had since my last supper at Sant Edhar, and stood there eating it and watching the pageant. Long-haired mountain men, always alone. A huge family, moving in a tight formation, males in broad-brimmed hats, females in face veils. A multiracial group, all wearing red t-shirts, every head, men's and women's alike, shaved clean. A race, if that was the right word, of tall people with bony noses and prematurely white hair, hawking fresh shellfish packed in polycrates full of seaweed. After I had been off the ship for an hour, it had become evident that meeting up with Cord, Saman, and the Crades could easily take more than one day. I started considering where I might sleep that night, for I had at last reached a latitude where the sun went down for a few hours at this time of year. I knew that there were no great consents this far north, but in a city as old as this one, there had to be at least one small math, perhaps even one dating to the old Mathic age. Wondering if I should try to seek one out and talk my way in, I walked up a broad street that ran from the waterfront up to the Bayesian Cathedral, scanning the fronts of old buildings for Mathic architecture or anything that looked like a cloister. Clamped to a black iron lamppost, I noticed a spelecaptor, and this put me in mind of Saman and his ability to obtain data from such devices. Perhaps I've been going about this in the wrong way. It could be that Saman was tracking me on spelecaptors, but that my friends hadn't been able to catch up with me because I kept moving around. So I decided to remain still for a while in a conspicuous place and see if that helped. I had just bumped into Malter and Alwash, who had given me the address of a Kelk's mission hostel, where I might be able to sleep in a pinch, and as long as I had such a backup plan, I thought it might be worth the gamble to sit and wait somewhere. I chose a spot in the open plaza before the cathedral, in direct view of a spelecaptor bracketed to the front of Old Masht's town hall. That's where I got mugged. Or at least I thought it was a mugging at first. My attention had been drawn to a street performer doing gymnastics about 50 feet away.
"Hey, Vit!"
someone said, behind me on the right. I turned my face straight into an onrushing fist. While I was down, someone jerked my sweater up out of my trousers to bare my midsection. For some reason, I thought of Leo, who'd been defeated at Appert when the slimes had pulled his bolt over his head. So instead of protecting my face, as I ought to have done, I made a clumsy effort to push my sweater back down where it belonged. Someone's hands were busy down there, jerking something out of the waistband of my trousers. It was my bolt, cord, and sphere. I'd made them up into a neat package and stuffed them into my trousers for safekeeping and covered them with the sweater. Ground level makes for lousy vantage point, especially when you're on one side in a fetal position looking up out of the corner of one eye. But it seemed as though two men were playing tug-of-war with the package they had stolen from me, trying to get it apart. The cord spiraled off, and the bolt, which I'd pleated into a configuration called the eightfold envelope, fell open. Out tumbled my pilled-up sphere. I caught it on the second bounce. A foot smashed down on my hand.
"He's trying to use it!"
someone cried. A man dropped on me, one knee to either side. At this point, a reflex took over. Leo had taught me that once I'd been mounted, I'd never get up again. And so when I sensed what was happening, I twisted sideways, getting my back up and my belly down, and drew my knees up under me, so that by the time this guy's weight landed on me, I was presenting my butt to him rather than my belly, and I had my legs under me where I could use them. My hand was still pinned to the ground by someone's foot, but my sphere was trapped between my hand and the pavement. I made it bigger. The expanding sphere forced the man's foot up, and when it became head-sized, his foot rolled right off and my hand came free. I planted that hand under me and pushed as hard as I could with both arms and legs. The guy on top of me wrapped his arms around my trunk as I came up, but I grabbed one of his pinkies in my fist and jerked it back. He screamed and let go. I surged forward without looking back.
"He used a spell on me!"
someone screamed.
"The Vout cast a spell on me!"
Part of me, not the wiser part, wanted to explain to that guy what an idiot he was being, but most of me just wanted to put distance between myself and these mysterious attackers. How had they known I had been using the name Vit? I turned back to look at them. My passage through the crowd had left an open space in my wake. Several men were charging into it, coming for me. I had never seen them before. There was something familiar in their faces, though. They belonged to the same ethnic group as Laro and Dag. Geeths, as Braj had called them. They were having trouble keeping up with me, but I could not outrun their voices.
"Stop him! Stop the Vout!"
This didn't seem to have much effect, but then they got cleverer.
"Murderer! Murderer! Stop him!"
It turned out that this only made things easier for me, since no one wanted to get in the way of a large, sprinting murderer. So then it became,
"Thief! Thief! He stole an old lady's money!"
That was when the crowd closed in, and people started sticking legs out to trip me. I jumped over a few of those, but it was obvious I had to get out of this crowded square, so I dodged into the first street I could reach that led away from it, then into an alley off that street. This was so narrow I could touch both sides, but at least I didn't have the feeling anymore of being engulfed in a huge and hostile mob. I heard the buzz of scooter engines. They were tracking me. Local scooter boys, who knew the alley network, were maneuvering to cut me off at the next intersection. I tried a few doors, but they were locked. Then I made the mistake of doing so in view of an armed guard who was standing in front of a money-changing house a few doors up. He unslung a weapon and muttered something into his collar. I backtracked, took the next side alley that I could find, and ran down it for 100 yards to a place where it bridged a narrow canal. A couple of scooter boys pulled up to block the bridge just as I reached it. Glancing down, I saw some mucky canal bottom exposed. The tide must be out. I jumped down without thinking, landed and rolled in the soft mud, felt pain but didn't break anything as far as I could tell. To one direction, the canal curved back toward the town square. The other direction led to open sky, the waterfront. I began running that way, thinking that if I could get to the beach, I might steal or beg a ride on a small boat. Even swimming would be safer than being in the middle of that crowd. But I couldn't run very fast in the muck, and I was exhausted anyway. I'd forgotten to breathe. Bridges spanned the canal every couple of 100 feet, and I began to see people gathering on the bridges ahead of me, pointing at me excitedly. I turned around to see a bigger crowd on the bridge behind. They had bottles and stones ready. Trying to run under those bridges would be suicide. The canal wall was vertical, but the stonework was ancient and rough cut. I tried to scale it. Scooter noise zeroed in on me, and something hit me on the top of the head. I woke up some time after landing in knee-deep water in the middle of the canal and came up howling for air, only to get hit by a dozen stones and bottles in as many seconds.
"Stop! Stop! The vault isn't going anywhere! Keep him penned in!"
said some kind of self-appointed leader, a stout geith with shaggy hair.
"Our witness is almost here," he proclaimed.
So we all waited for the witness. The crowd sorted itself. Most of them had been random people who had been drawn to the bridges or the canal brink by simple curiosity, or out of the belief that they were helping to collar a purse snatcher. But those sorts drifted away, or were pushed aside by new arrivals, geeths with gee-jaws. So by the time that the witness arrived on the back of a pedal-powered cab a minute or so later, 100% of those staring down at me were geeths, and none of them believed that I was a purse snatcher. What did they believe? I doubted most of them even cared. The witness was Laro. His leg was in a military-issue cast.
"That is him! I'll never forget his face! He used vowed sorcery to save himself, but left our kinsman Dag for dead!"
I looked at him like, "You have got to be kidding!" But the look on his face was so sincere it made me doubt my own version of the story.
"The cops are coming!"
someone warned. Actually, we'd been hearing such warnings the whole time I'd been at bay here. I wished those cops would hurry, but I wasn't sure they'd treat me any better.
"Let's get this done,"
someone shouted, and looked to the leader, who stepped to the brink. Sidling along next to him was a big guy holding a huge chunk of pavement above his head in both hands and staring at me intently. The leader pointed down at me.
"He's a vout. Laro testifies to it. These two found the evidence hidden under his clothes."
Two young geeths, the pair who had mugged me, were pushed to the front of the crowd so vigorously they almost fell in. They had my bolt, cord, and sphere. At the leader's prompting, they raised these up for all to see. The crowd oohed and awed at the exhibits, as if they were nuclear bomb cores.
"The vout has broken the ancient law that keeps his kind apart. He has come among us as a spy. We all know what he did to poor Dag. We can only imagine what fate he had in store for Laro, had Laro not bravely fought his way free of the vout's snare. Are we going to stand for it?"
"No,"
the crowd shouted.
"Are we going to get any justice from the cops?"
"No."
"But are we going to see justice done?"
"Yes."
The leader nodded at the big guy with the rock. He flung it down at me so ponderously that I was able to step out of its path with ease. But a score of smaller, faster projectiles came in its wake. Running back and forth just to make myself a moving target, I caught sight of a stone stairway in the canal about 100 feet distant. If I could get to its top, I'd at least be at street level again, not in this hopeless situation, down below the mob. I ran for it and took several more bottles and rocks in my back, but I had my arms folded behind my head to shield it. I got to the top of those stairs all right, but they were waiting for me there. I had scarcely ascended to street level before they had tripped and shoved me down onto the street. One of them fell on me, or maybe it was a clumsy attempt to tackle me. I grabbed the lapel of his jacket and held him there, keeping him on top of me as a shield. People elbowed each other aside to get in and aim kicks at me, but most of them drew up short when they saw one of their own people in the way. Hands reached in to grab him and haul him to his feet. I ended up with his empty jacket clutched in my hand. I tried to get up, but was pushed down. I went to a fetal position and clamped my arms over my head. It was a few seconds later that I heard the scream. The scream was definitely a human voice, but it was unlike anything I'd ever heard. The only way I can convey just how disturbing it was is to say that it fully expressed the way I was feeling. I even wondered, in my panicked and addled state, whether it might have escaped from my own throat. The scream had the effect of making everyone stand still. They were no longer attacking me, no longer fighting to get within kicking distance. Instead, all stood around, trying to figure out where the scream had come from and what it portended. I rolled over on my back. A space had opened up around me. Around me, that is, and a shaven-headed man in a red t-shirt. He stepped toward me and drew something from his pocket that rapidly became large. A sphere. In a second, he had expanded it to about 5 feet in diameter, leaving it somewhat flaccid. He doubled it over me. My head and feet stuck out to either end, but the rest of me was shielded against further blows, at least as long as this man stood there holding the sphere in place. A gust of wind could dislodge it, but he took care of that by vaulting to its top and perching on it, a precarious pose even when you attempted it with both feet. He, however, was placing all of his weight on one foot, leaving the other drawn up beneath him. Sometimes, when we'd been younger, we had tried to stand on our spheres as a kind of childish game. Some adults did it as an exercise to improve their balance and reflexes. This seemed an odd time and place for calisthenics, though. It did have the useful side effect of leaving the people around me even more nonplussed than they had been by the scream. But after a few moments, one young man spied my head, a tempting and obvious target, and stepped toward me, drawing back one leg to deliver a kick. I closed my eyes and braced myself. Above me, I heard a sharp percussive sound. I opened my eyes to see my attacker falling backwards. A second later, moisture sprayed into my face, a shower of blood. A few small pebbles or something rattled to the pavement nearby. Blinking the blood out of my eyes, I perceived that they weren't pebbles, but teeth. Another scream emanated from the edge of the crowd. This one was altogether different. It came from a person who was experiencing an amount of pain that was incredible, in the literal sense. His scream sounded surprised, as in, "I had no idea anything could be as painful as whatever is happening to me now." This got the attention of everyone except for one Geeth, who was coming toward me and my protector with an odd, fixed grin on his face, drawing a knife from his pocket and flicking it open. This time, I got a better view of what happened. The man perched on the sphere above me faked a snap kick with his free leg, and the other waved his knife at where he supposed the kick was going. But before he even knew how badly he had missed, my protector had grabbed the hand holding the knife and twisted it the wrong way. Not simply by flicking his wrist, but by jumping off the sphere and doing a mid-air somersault over the attacker's arm, whose joints and bones came undone in a series of thuds and pops. The sphere rolled off of me. The knife fell to the ground and I tried to clap my hand down on top of it, but too late. My protector kicked it away, and it flew over the brink of the canal and disappeared. I was unshielded, but it hardly mattered because the crowd had all moved in the direction of that horrible, astonished screaming. I pushed myself up on hands and knees and got to a kneeling position. The source of the screaming was an adult male Geeth who was being held in some sort of complicated wrestling grip by a shaven-headed woman in a red t-shirt. A similar-looking man of about 18 was standing at her back, efficiently knocking down anyone who approached. By the time I came in view of all this, the mob had begun to hurl stones at these two. My protector abandoned me and slipped through the crowd to join the other two red shirts and help bat away projectiles. They began to retreat. Most of the mob went after them, but some began to edge away. Throwing stones at a lone avout might have been good sport for them, but they wanted no part of whatever was going on now. I turned, thinking I might just get out of here now, and found myself staring into the eyes of the Geath leader. He had a gun. It was aimed at me.
"No," he said. "We haven't forgotten about you. Move."
He gestured with the gun in the direction that the crowd seemed to be moving. They were slowly pursuing the retreating redshirts down the edge of the canal toward a more open place 100 feet away, a square where two streets met at canal's edge.
"Turn around and march," he commanded.